The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. It's day 23 of the Russian conflict in Ukraine. As heavy fighting continues near the capital, Kiev, Mariupol and several other cities in the east and south remain under siege as well. At a rally in the Russian capital, President Vladimir Putin defended the Russian operation in Ukraine, saying that Moscow had no choice but to enter the country as the U.S. was using it to threaten Russia. Moscow also says it's close to fulfilling one of its demands, which is to keep Ukraine neutral. The U.S., on the other hand, is now concerned that China will help Russia circumvent economic sanctions imposed by Western nations. Washington says Beijing will bear responsibility if it supports Russia's military action in Ukraine. Let's take a look at the guests that we have for tonight's Spotlight. Radio host, journalist, and political activist Don DeBar is joining us from New York. And the Balkan Foreign Executive Director, Astrid Istrefi, is joining us from Pristina.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Don DeBar in New York. The U.S. Right now is concerned that China could help Russia circumvent economic sanctions imposed by Western nations. Washington also says that Beijing will bear responsibility if it supports Russia's military action in Ukraine. Talk to us about Washington's concerns and whether they are warranted or not.
Well, first, on the face, China said that they see American sanctions as illegal, and China said we are not bound by anyone's illegal sanctions. That's what they're saying now. If you go back to 2014, when the U.S., the Obama administration, decided it was going to try to sanction Russia into submission after the Crimea referendum, the first thing that China did was sign the largest business deal in the history of the world with Russia, more or less guaranteeing them some pretty steady business for 40 or 50 years thereafter. I don't think that the United States has the wherewithal to go full-throttle battle with China. If the United States and China were to divorce right now in terms of their economies, the United States would take back all its money and stock certificates, and China would keep the factories and the workers. That is not exactly a prescription for victory on Washington's side. And finally, the policy that's being made, by the person at the top is literally, as the spokesperson for President Putin pointed out in response to some pretty crazy remarks Biden made, he's suffering from classic symptoms that it wasn't pointed out in such detail or quite as coldly as this, but of dementia. The DSM-5, memory loss, difficulty communicating or finding words, difficulty with visual and spatial abilities, like tripping and falling down several times as you climb into a plane, difficulty reasoning or problem solving, a very germane problem at the moment, as well as difficulty handling complex tasks, difficulty with coordination and motor functions, again, tripping and falling multiple times, and confusion and disorientation, as in U.S. policy at the moment, for example, Afghanistan. You know, we're not working with John F. Kennedy at the pinnacle of the U.S. government at this moment of crisis where we're very close to a war with Russia. And for the United States to decide that this is the time to take on China shows that perhaps there's another page in the DSM-5 that needs to be looked at, something closer to a psychosis.
Mr. Estreffi, the U.S., it's been cranking up its threatening rhetoric over China's military and economic cooperation with Russia. We've been discussing that with Mr. DeVar right now. In the past, we know that the Chinese President Xi Jinping said that he respects Russia's actions regarding Ukraine. Beijing would support Moscow at the U.N. Many observers are saying that we're witnessing the end of a unipolar world as we know it. Do you see it in that light as well?
Well, obviously, the world is not as it used to be before the Russian aggression in Ukraine. And that's clear. I think this is a defining moment for the world. And I really don't think it's about Russia and United States. It's about, or China and United States. It's about Russia and the entire world. I mean, just the voting itself in the United Nations General Assembly tells it that it's majority of the countries in the world condemning Russian aggression in Ukraine. And even China has abstained, which gives an indication that at least in the General Assembly, they are not aligning clearly with Russia. So I think this is a question of, you know, where, how far Russia will go and what are the other actions that will be taken not only by United States, but by most of the countries in the world who are concerned and sees as a threat to peace, to freedom and democracy.
Mr. DeBar, I saw you shaking your head there. If you'd like to add anything to what Mr. Estreffi is saying right now.
Yeah, plenty. First of all, it's U.S. and NATO forces that are gathered around the borders of Russia, and included in that, they're placed in three former Soviet republics. And if you count what's in Ukraine and what's been toyed with in Georgia, and if you look at the former member of the former member states of the Warsaw Pact, all of these were supposed to be off limits when Russia, as the only of the four powers that occupied Germany after World War II, agreed to leave and give Germany that much sovereignty. I note the United States military still occupies Germany in that context. The agreement was founded on a promise that has been, you know, memorialized in about eight different venues now from people on the U.S. side of it in the media, that they would not move their forces any closer to Russia than they were at the time that Germany was reunited, the Elbe River. Now, instead, you have an assembly of forces, military drills and exercises ongoing from practically the beginning of the Obama administration, with some respite during the Trump administration, under a cloud of accusations that the president of the United States was a stooge of Putin for doing that. And then open talk in Ukraine while people are marching under Hitler's flag, goose-stepping at torchlit ceremonies at night talking about killing Russians, about let's get our nuclear weapons back. I'm amazed, first of all, that for 8 years, while Russians were being bombed repeatedly, incessantly, while 14,000 Ukrainians, two-thirds of whom were killed in the eastern part of the country, were murdered by the government in Kiev, installed by the United States, with the people of Russia and the people of Donbass begging the Russian government to intervene, that it took 8 years. But the pressure finally reached a point when the Duma, when the parliament, had to act because the demand was so great among the people of Russia. I speak to people in Russia on a regular basis, and I have for the entire duration of this, and all they would do is say, we can't believe this government isn't doing anything. You know, if a kid gets arrested in Turkey or something, the Marines are ready to land and remove them from jail. Ask the Israelis what they would do if one of their pilots ended up in a Syrian jail. Russia sat there with the assembled NATO forces across its western border and the U.S. Navy in Okinawa and elsewhere on its eastern border for 8 years watching Russians get slaughtered with the promise of exterminating them, and they finally acted.
Okay.
So maybe they're not justified. Maybe it takes something like fake incubator babies like the United States before you destroy a country and kill millions of people. I mean, let's look at the same, you know, the scales on balance.
Let's bring in our guest in Pristina, Mr. Estreffi. I'd like to get your response to Mr. DeBar. Also, earlier you were talking about how far are world countries willing to go to show they're aligned or opposed with Russia. But what about Russia itself? It's stated its objectives. It's stated that it wants to see its operations in Ukraine till the end. How far is Russia willing to go here?
Well, I mean, let me just quickly comment on Mr. DeBar. I think it's really a misinterpretation that Mr. DeBar is doing, and I think it's, you know, just going back far into trying to draw analogies with other contexts, and I think that is really not useful at all. But I think, as I said in the beginning, it's Russia against the whole world. We are not talking about countries around the world. We are talking about multi-billion, multinational companies and cultural and sports associations and media and civil society and citizens that are condemning Russia. It's really a matter of Russia against everybody. And I think, you know, it's difficult to kind of predict what Russia is going to do or is capable of doing. But I think one thing is clear, that Russia has failed itself right now, and Putin has it failed Russia. It's already defeated because it's trying to do a war that cannot win.
Mr. DeBar, you'd like to answer? Yeah, you'd like to respond to that?
I would. As far as the UN goes, I should have addressed that before. I'm sorry. First of all, you have two, you know, pulse takings at the United Nations. One was the Security Council on two different occasions, actually. One was whether or not to bring a resolution before the Security Council, and then was the vote on the resolution at the Security Council. And then second was the, you know, basically symbolic or ceremonial vote at the General Assembly. General Assembly, first of all, for people that don't know, has, I believe, 193 members now. I haven't looked in a couple of days. Each nation state member of the General Assembly has one vote. The United States has one vote. China, which has about 20% or better of humanity's population, has one vote. Palau, which has three guys and a palm tree, has one vote. And across the landscape of nation states, there are the European and North American colonial powers, basically. The old colonial powers, Spain, Britain, France, etc. And then the United States, which sort of succeeded to all of that after World War II, and their colonies in one block. And then the people who have fallen outside of it or escaped it to date in another. If you look at a map of the world against the vote in the General Assembly, the U.S., Europe, and their colonies voted one way, and the others voted the other. In terms of human population, I'll just mention two of the people that abstained at the General Assembly, because the vote against is meaningless. This is a symbolism. Both China and India voted, abstained from the vote. That's about 3 billion people between the two of them in a population of 7 billion. All, by the way, of the BRICS countries, including Brazil, abstained, and South Africa. And South Africa is also continuing to not, none of these are going to honor U.S. sanctions against Russia, by the way. And there's some very important structures around the world, part of the Belt and Road Initiative, CELAC and the Western Hemisphere and others, that want nothing to do with the United States' position on this, that have friendly relations with Russia and with China, and are not going to be bullied. I would say Iran, Venezuela, and a number of other very important oil producers, for example, are among those. And what we're looking at, by the way, is the weakening and perhaps the demise of the dollar as the world's hard currency as just one of the pieces of blowback of this overreach by the United States. So it's not the whole world versus Russia. The media here is trying to portray it that way, but about half the population of the world knows that that's not true, even if they don't know that in Pristina.
Mr. Zdreffy, Washington, yeah, you can respond to that as well. Also, let me throw in this question. Washington has pledged a further $800 million in military assistance for Ukraine. I'd like to get your thoughts on that as well. Is this the level of support Ukraine was expecting from the U.S. and co.? And also, if you'd like to respond to Mr. DeBar's comments as well, go ahead.
Sure. Even if symbolic, I think it's fundamental to understand that symbolism has been translated into 141 countries of the world, members of United Nations, condemning Russia. 35 among those who Mr. DeBar mentioned abstained. Even if symbolic, they could have well been on the side of Russia to vote against, as there were 5, including Russia. And honestly, I just feel that had Putin known that Bashar al-Assad is going to vote against, in opposition, or supporting Russia, I don't think he would have wanted that. And it's just, North Korea, I think we have to understand just how firm is the entire world, without exaggerating, on Russian aggression in against Ukraine. The other thing, I don't think Ukraine expected the support that U.S. or the other countries are providing. I think 100 million, 2 billion, 20 billion is not sufficient. If we are witnessing the devastation that is taking place in Ukraine and that children are being killed, murdered, indiscriminate fighting and shelling, I think Ukraine and Europe and NATO should do more, and I think they should respond clearly and firmly to the needs of Ukraine. And that should go beyond just financial and diplomatic support to Ukraine.
Mr. Zdreffy, I want to stay with you for a second there. I'm sure you would agree that there's been a clear double standard and hypocrisy regarding reactions to this war. So many countries, as we know, have chimed in with sanctions and censuring Russia, but that has not been the case in so many of the other wars and conflicts and invasions that we've seen over the past 20 years. Why is that?
Well, I think every situation is unique, and I think it's really not very helpful in trying to compare situations like alike. It's too difficult. It's challenging. And it just goes into kind of trying to interpret the situations and identifying analogies that don't fit. So I think it's a unique situation now with Ukraine. It's the heart of Europe. It's against countries at the end of the day that don't want to be dealing with Russia or have anything to do with Russia, want to join EU and NATO. And it's not only Ukraine, it's Georgia, it's Armenia. There are other countries that are in the proximity of Russia, and if you will, in that borderline that sets the NATO expansion or not. But I think even Eastern European countries and the Western Balkan countries are looking forward to joining and be part of those values and aspirations that they want to. And the Russian invasion tells it that it wants to hold the country back against their will, against what their aspirations are. It's a matter of values. It's a matter of aspirations of the people of Ukraine.
Mr. DeBar, we're talking about the double standard reactions to this war. Mr. Zdreffy says that it's kind of difficult to draw comparisons between these different situations. I think in the bigger picture, when we're talking about women and children being killed and occupations happening like the one that's happening in occupied Palestine, There are hypocrisy and double standards in the reactions that we've been seeing. I'd like you to offer a rebuttal to what our guest in Pristina has said as well.
Yeah, I'm the oldest of six kids. I grew up as the oldest of the household full of kids. That's the argument that one of them getting caught doing something that another one has done uses to not get in trouble. It has nothing to do with the actual offense. There's a question I'd like to ask him, though, and just put out for the audience in general, and it's based in history. In 1962, the Cuban government, which was installed by a popular revolution 2 years earlier, which was attacked by the United States militarily shortly after it had established itself, on behalf of corporations that were large landowners that wanted their estates back and their money. And the Cuban government asked the Soviet Union for military protection, some assistance. The Soviet Union installed some nuclear-tipped missiles in Cuba that were analogous to, as a matter of fact, missiles that the United States had installed in Turkey on the border of the Soviet Union a year earlier. And the United States demanded that they be removed and was prepared to conduct global thermonuclear war over that. Now, I'd like to know what it is exactly about the United States that is so special that its integrity, physical integrity, military security should be worthy of defending at arm's length like that with the threat of nuclear war, while Russia facing the threat of nuclear war on its border in a slow roll, which is now placed at the apogee of Hitler's invasion. If NATO were to attack now, they would be attacking, with the exception of Belarus, from the deepest that Hitler went in with Operation Barbarossa, and that's without firing a shot. What is it exactly that entitles the United States to so much space for protection, and Russia nothing?
Okay, so let's hear the answer from Mr. Estreffi before we wrap up the program. Mr. Estreffi, would you like to answer that question?
It's really a situation that was critical 6 years ago, or even the Second World War 60 years ago. So I don't feel there is easy to draw any comparison between now and then. It's a different era. And I think it's not really helpful to try and do that. But let me tell you how Russia is perceived in the Western Balkans, in the region where I live. It's a country that produces fear and insecurity in the Western Balkans. And it's not the United States, it's not European Union. And I think it's really not good to try and misplace or put emphasis on something that is not. I think we are seeing a situation where European Union, where most of the countries around the world are seeing this as a threat to their security. They are seeing a threat to their peace and freedom and all to democracy. It's not only United
States. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to jump in there. That's all the time we have for the show. Allow me to thank my guests, radio host, journalist, and political activist Don DeBar, joining us from New York, and also the Balkan Forum Executive Director, Mr. Astrid Estreffi, joining us from Pristina. And also thanks to you all for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Suratul Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
لقد آتينا موسى الكتاب وجعلنا معه أخاه هارون وزيرا
And we had certainly given Moses the scripture and appointed with him his brother Aaron as an assistant.
فقلنا اذهبا إلى القوم الذين كذبوا بآياتنا فدمرناهم تدميرا
And we said, go both of you to the people who have denied our signs. Then we destroyed them with complete destruction.
Brothers and sisters, in the previous program, we started discussing another section of this chapter Furqan. We talked about the 35th verse. وَلَقَدْ أَتَيْنَا مُوسَى الْكِتَابِ وَجَعَلْنَا مَعْهُ أَخَاهَ هَارُونَ وَزِيرًا And indeed we gave Moses the book and we appointed his brother Aaron with him as his assistant. The 36th verse, however, continues,
فَقُلْنَا اذْهَبَا إِلَى الْقَوْمِ الَّذِينَ كَذَّبُوا بِآيَاتِنَا فَدَمَّرْنَاهُمْ تَدْمِيرًا
And we said, You go both unto the people who have rejected our signs. So we destroyed them with utter destruction. As we said earlier in the previous episode of the program, the Holy Quran is talking about the different nations, the history of the people of different prophets, and some of those gloomy destinies. And this is somehow to sympathize with the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and the believers, because the Holy Prophet, as the previous verses mentioned, had a lot of opponents on that time. He was alone. He did not have anyone else to turn to, and those opponents brought different pretexts and different false argumentations against him. Of course, the Holy Quran answered them. But in order to sympathize with the Prophet more, and of course to show the believers that the people who were rejecting their prophets had such a gloomy destiny, this section of the chapter specially puts emphasis on these nations. So at first it started with the story of Moses, his brother Aaron, that had to go to Pharaoh. The 36th verse says, فَقُلْنَا اذْهَبَا إِلَى الْقَوْمِ الَّذِينَ كَذَّبُوا بِآيَاتِنَا And we said, go you both unto the people who have rejected our signs.
مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So now we understand that narrating the history and the explanation of destiny of former pagans and the statement of their destruction is working as a warning for the pagans. This will prohibit them from what is unlawful, and at the same time, it is sympathizing with the Prophet and the people of the Prophet, and even the people and the followers of the Prophet nowadays. So, at the beginning of this verse, فَقُلْ نَذْهَبَ, we said, you go both. But to whom? إِلَى الْقَوْمِ الَّذِينَ كَذَّبُوا بِآيَاتِنَا. You have to go to the people who have rejected our signs. How did they reject the signs of the Almighty Allah? On one hand, they practically denied the divine revelations. They practically denied Allah's signs which existed in every aspect of their lives. The signs of the Almighty Allah are existent in the entire universe, in macrocosm and microcosm. And then they began to worship idols and to be polytheists. On the other hand, they neglected the teachings of the previous prophets, and they also denied the previous prophets. In spite of Moses and his brothers' attempts, since we're not going to discuss the story of those people of Moses, the people of Moses saw very great and various miracles, but they stuck to their paganism. They stuck to their denial of the truth, and as a result, they were destroyed. So the verse continues saying, فَدَمَّرْنَاهُمْ تَدْمِيرًا. So we destroyed them with utter destruction. 2 points remain to be discussed, dear listeners. The first is that although the people of Moses denied the signs of the Almighty Allah, but the mercy from the side of Almighty Allah was not stopped. He sent them a prophet to guide them, although they were denying his signs. So having sent a prophet to the misguided people is the embodiment of Almighty Allah's mercy. And the second point is that if you stay against the truth, the final result is utter and total destruction and humiliation. And this is what the Almighty Allah is telling the Prophet, is what the Almighty Allah is teaching the believers to know and to support them, to let them know that you have such a support, so do not stop continue to reach your aims with the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
There is consensus at the highest political and military levels in the West that closing Ukraine's airspace to Russia would likely trigger World War III and potentially result in a catastrophic nuclear war. Despite this, many EU legislators suggest it's time for NATO to become directly involved in the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
Unfortunately, our good friends from Washington, they were too afraid. They were afraid that they are triggering the war. But I can't imagine where we're going to trigger the war. Europe is in the war already.
But a debate on the subject in the European Parliament on Thursday heard calls for peace rather than further intervention.
I don't think this war can be won militarily from one side, and therefore it is essential that we do all we can to ensure there is a ceasefire.
According to some experts, the conflict will become protracted as both sides are very unlikely to back down.
Ukraine is not going to give these things to Russia. I mean, President Zelensky has talked about this neutrality issue. That's one thing. But when it comes to actual territory and the other things that Russia is asking for, I mean, this is just non-negotiable.
Via video link, the Ukrainian Defense Minister, Alexei Reznikov, told MEPs that more than 3 million people have fled his country so far. Many nations have simplified visa regimes in order to assist. He explained.
Unlike other countries like Israel, for example, that actually made it more difficult for our refugees to unite with their families in Israel, I was very surprised by that.
During this debate, the governments of Spain, Bulgaria and Turkey were heavily criticized for not fully backing the West's anti-Russia agenda. In recent debates here, lawmakers who support Russia have been demonized. At present, it appears, any form of balance on this subject is unacceptable to most. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An incredible act of bravery against a ruthless occupation. An activist there to expose Israeli crimes.
I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive. And that is incredibly horrifying.
23-year-old activist Rachel Corey from Olympia, Washington, crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer on its way to demolish yet another Palestinian home in a dark corner of Gaza near the border with Egypt. To her family and eyewitnesses, her killing was intentional. That the driver of the bulldozer could not have missed a blonde-haired foreign activist wearing an orange fluorescent jacket. To the Israeli courts, it was merely a regrettable accident. Her case was closed, but the debate over her death caught on. Rachel Corrie became synonymous with solidarity for the Palestinian cause.
Rachel Corrie, as with a number of other people who've borne the brunt of Zionist attacks, are a symbol, aren't they, in the West, for people who have bravely allied themselves with the Palestinian struggle. I suppose that's the truth, that she's a symbol of resistance.
An example of how Rachel Corrie's activism resonates with activists today is how non-Palestinians are calling out Western media for glorifying Ukraine for things that Palestinians have been doing for years.
At a time of continued Palestinian disappointment over several Arab governments normalizing ties with Israel and the Western double standard over the crisis in Ukraine, the legacy of people such as Rachel Corrie acts as a reminder of the decades-long Palestinian struggle for justice. Saeed Pourreza, London.
A recent UN-organized pledging conference on Yemen raised only $1.3 billion, less than a third what is needed to help millions of poor people in Yemen. That's despite the fact the dire humanitarian situation in Yemen is getting worse day by day.
The so-called pledging conference held by the United Nations is meant to attract funding for United Nations programs and not to save the lives of Yemenis. Unfortunately, the coalition has recently tightened the siege in an attempt to achieve what they couldn't get in their military cooperation in Yemen. This will only cause a surge in cases of malnutrition and other diseases.
Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Qatar pledged no aid on Yemen this year. Riyadh's representative said Saudi Arabia has in recent years provided Yemenis with over $19 billion in aid. Observers say Saudi Arabia is deliberately deepening what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Members of the Saudi-led coalition refused to offer any financial grants to Yemen at the recent pledging conference, saying that they had already extended much aid. This shows that these countries insist on pushing Yemen deeper into a humanitarian crisis that the United Nations describes as the worst in the world. The Saudi-led coalition is tightening the news on Yemenis by tightening the blockade and preventing Yemen from importing fuel, so they are the key players in creating this forgotten tragedy.
The drive on Yemen fell short of its goal as the number of needy people in Yemen has risen from 20 million in the last year to 23 million now.
Funding shortages have already forced aid agencies to downsize life-saving assistance programs. To make matters worse, funding for the humanitarian response in Yemen gets smaller and smaller. The failure of the UN pledging conference poses a real threat to lives of millions of Yemenis who rely solely on humanitarian aid to survive. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Cut away the gigantic mountain to get to your love. It was an impossible condition set by the 6th century Iranian king Khosrow to dissuade Farhad from marrying Shirin, his love. But the enchanted lover accepted the daring offer and used his sculpting axe to dig through Mount Bisotun. But halfway through, Farhad heard the sad news that King Khosrow had already married Shirin. This tragic love story still echoes in the Iranian city of Kermanshah and Mount Bisotun, which is now hosting visitors from across Iran to celebrate the Persian New Year, known as Nowruz. Bisotun is just one of many historical sites in Iran's western province of Kermanshah. Anahita Temple is equally significant. The historical monument was constructed back in the 4th century BC to honor the goddess of water, Anahita. And in the heart of Kermanshah lies this amazing stone arch called Tagh-e-Bostan, which dates back to some 2,400 years ago. What made it even more attractive is music performances by local ensembles who sing and play the tambour instrument to ring in Nowruz.
Happy Nowruz to all Iranians. Today our group played the tambour, an old Iranian instrument that is 8,000 years old. We hosted music bands from other parts of Iran and enjoyed their performances.
Kermanshah was the second stop for the caravan of Nowruz, comprising cultural activists from across Iran, who took part to welcome the Persian New Year, due on March 21st. The caravan set out from Hamadan, got here in Kermanshah, and will move on to Sanandaj. all to display Iran's cultural diversity. That's the result of peaceful coexistence of many ethnicities in the country.
Nowruz is celebrated by over 300 million people worldwide, with each nation having its own unique style in marking the occasion. Now, these people say Nowruz is a time to celebrate these differences, as they make the ancient festivity one of the most ethnically diverse cultural events in the world. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Kermanshah.
An emergency meeting of NATO defense ministers concluded at the military alliance's headquarters in Brussels on Wednesday. They are ready to defend NATO countries in the event Russia expands its mission beyond Ukraine, it's claimed.
There are now hundreds of thousands of forces at heightened alert across the alliance. 100,000 US troops in Europe.
A number of analysts have asked the question, how would Washington feel if Russia positioned 100,000 of its troops, for example, in Mexico? NATO military commanders have been ordered to examine how there can be even further expansion with respect to land, sea, air, cyber, and space capabilities. Jens Stoltenberg has called on NATO members to spend at least 2% of their GDP to grow military forces in response to Russia. Western powers say they won't get directly involved in the Ukraine conflict, but will continue to spend billions on arming Ukraine.
Certainly, we support their ability to defend themselves, and we'll continue to support them going forward.
Unprecedented sanctions against Moscow are starting to hit the EU's economy hard as fuel prices continue to rise and the cost of living generally goes up.
Those are substantial costs that that will have to be paid by the EU collectively, but of course they will hit certain countries harder.
Sanctions are not the answer when it comes to dealing with Russia, according to some experts.
It's not a good situation because it seems to me there are a few mistakes. First of all, such kind of sanctions will be counterproductive generally. It's a way to confrontation.
As the war rages on, Joe Biden and other NATO leaders are due to hold a summit in the Belgian capital on Thursday of next week to consider further options. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Mid Shaban is one of Muslims' great Eids, marking the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi, the 12th Shia Imam. Afghans gathered here at Sahi Shrine in Kabul to pay tribute to their last Imam and celebrate the occasion.
I congratulate Afghans and other Muslims on the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi. This is a joyous Eid for us and we have come here to celebrate it. Prophet Muhammad has promised the advent of Mahdi, and we are eagerly waiting for that day. May he come and fill the world with justice and peace.
Fortunately, here everything looks great. People are happy celebrating Mid Shaban. As an Afghan, I mark the birth anniversary of Mid Shaban every year, but today it's different. More families have come here since the security threats are gone.
Kabul residents decorate the Sahi Shrine and hold traditional ceremonies, announcing their allegiance to Imam Mahdi. They also take the occasion as a chance for highlighting Islamic solidarity among Muslims. At the same time, the Taliban say they will tighten the security during the Eid.
God willing, we have tightened security everywhere. We are serving all people of Afghanistan and don't let anything or anyone threaten them. Today, people can mark their occasions without trouble.
People in Afghanistan have been struggling with poverty and hunger crisis. In the meantime, they don't miss any chance to mark cultural occasions and to spread Islamic bliss. People have come here for the love of their last Imam, Hazrat Mahdi. They observe Mid Shaban as a great Eid and hold such ceremonies every year. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A coalition of truckers, farmers, fishermen, and public contractors are blocking refineries as oil prices in France have hit an all-time high, surpassing 2 euros per liter. Added to higher costs at the pump is inflation in prices of food and general goods, as well as looming shortages of vital industrial commodities. France could be headed for a spring of economic discontent amid a presidential election.
Début 2021, le prix du brut était à $51 le baril.
At the start of 2021, the price of gas was at $50 a barrel. First, we had the demand shock caused by the end of coronavirus lockdowns. And then we had a supply shock caused by the failure to meet that demand shock. And now we have the unrest in Ukraine, shocking not just the oil market, but seemingly every market. It's been quite a roller coaster.
Last week, the European Union decided against sanctioning Russian fossil fuels, which would have provoked catastrophic economic consequences. However, France has just announced plans to end Russian gas and oil imports in just 5 years. They also announced a package of measures designed to protect French businesses and consumers from rampant inflation, but there's not much they can do about the actual price of oil.
Absolument pas. Non, la dynamique de l'OPEP.
The French government can do absolutely nothing about this situation. It's Russia and Saudi Arabia which have decided the price of oil in recent years, and it's according to their financial and budgetary needs. These two used to care about not making the Americans angry over high prices, but no one really knows how current geopolitical changes will develop. What's certain is that France and Europe have no control over oil prices.
The government recently announced a rebate of 15 cents per liter on all gasoline from April 1st until August 1st, but they didn't do one thing in their power: reduce gasoline taxes.
In France, two-thirds of the price of gas comes from taxes. Gas taxes are regressive and not progressive because they hurt the lower classes more than the rich. In 2018, the Yellow Vest movement was sparked by an increase in gas taxes.
Gas prices back then were just €1.50 per liter, illustrating how precarious the situation is for the average Frenchman and perhaps for politicians facing re-election. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As the cost of living in the EU goes through the roof, union members held a demonstration outside a meeting of EU finance ministers in Brussels on Tuesday. They want the bloc's leaders to provide more support for EU citizens who are being hit hard by the financial ramifications resulting from the conflict in Ukraine.
And it's also why we need to say that we need to stop this war because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation, and now we have to say stop. Stop this war and stop Putin in Ukraine.
Finance ministers have signed off on the fourth package of sanctions against Russia. 600 individuals have been targeted and Russian exports too. However, there is a very negative boomerang effect for the EU itself.
We'll see overall higher inflation, pressure on energy and food prices and market volatility. Rising energy and commodity prices, disruptions of supply chains, it all will have negative knock-off effect on consumer prices and on investment.
Russia, which is now the most sanctioned country in the world, has been removed from the so-called Most Favoured Nation clause relating to the World Trade Organization.
This major decision entitles the EU to increase customs duties at any moment on Russian products. As regards sanctions, all options remain on the table.
Finance ministers say €200 billion worth of loans are available to EU nations most impacted by the Ukrainian refugee crisis. Critics say if Western leaders had have shown more skill and compromise when listening to Russia's security concerns, the misery now being piled on Ukrainian citizens and the financial hardship being placed on EU citizens could have been avoided. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As the Ukraine exodus intensifies, Poland's major cities are starting to show signs of strain under the pressure, with local authorities warning that they simply can't cope with more arrivals.
This is just one of the many border crossings between Poland and Ukraine. Just behind me, a few meters, is Ukraine. Now, all day long, we've been witnessing coaches, vans, cars going backwards and forwards, supplies and aid going in, people and refugees coming out.
Whilst here, we managed to speak with Max, a Ukrainian from the Czech Republic. He's been waiting hours for his mother-in-law, who has fled from Kyiv. Speaking to Press TV, he informed us about his anger at the lack of help he sees on the ground from the rest of Europe.
I have no words how to describe overall situation. It's horrible. When people just crossing by in winter with kids, I have no words how to describe this situation. Frankly, there is support from Europe, but perhaps not quite enough.
Then, suddenly, a call came through. Alex's mother-in-law had finally arrived.
I'm glad that we have finally succeeded.
Reunited again, finally. They now can head off to safety. But many more refugees aren't so lucky and remain stranded without key essentials. With reports of at least two Ukrainians crossing the Polish border every 3 seconds, how long can Poland maintain this huge humanitarian effort? Robert Carter, Dorohusk.
Iran expects a good agreement to be reached in the near future in its talks on the revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. This was made by Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian at a press conference following talks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Moscow. Amir Abdollahian said the delay in the negotiations could lead to the creation of good ground for resolving the remaining issues. He also said that Russia has not created any obstacles in the negotiations on the JCPOA revival, and that the Vienna talks are in no way connected with the conflict in Ukraine.
Russia does not create any obstacles to reaching agreements. There is no connection between the developments in Ukraine and the Vienna talks. And until the end of the negotiations and the achievement of a good, powerful and lasting agreement, Russia will be close to Iran and will support Iran to achieve this agreement.
Meanwhile, Sergei Lavrov said his country has received written guarantees from the United States that Western sanctions on Russia over Ukraine will not affect cooperation with Iran within the framework of the JCPOA.
We received written guarantees. They are included in the text of the agreement itself on the resumption of the JCPOA on the Iranian nuclear program. These texts provide reliable protection for all the projects and areas of activity envisaged by the JCPOA, including the direct involvement of our companies, specialists, including their cooperation on such a flagship project of our cooperation as the Bushehr nuclear power plant, in the context of all existing plans in this regard.
Lavrov also rejected claims that Russia has created an obstacle to negotiations in the Austrian capital, backing the quick revival of the 2015 agreement.
There have been no exorbitant demands from our side, and there are none. All our rights within the framework of cooperation with Iran on the projects that the JCPOA provides for are reliably protected. I have heard how the Americans are trying to accuse us every day that we are slowing down this agreement. That's a lie. The agreement has not yet been finally approved in some capitals, and the Russian capital, Moscow, is not among them.
Amir Abdollahian and Lavrov also discussed other issues, including the Ukrainian conflict and regional issues such as developments in Afghanistan, Syria, and Yemen.
The foreign ministers, along with political and diplomatic issues, discussed economic affairs in order to neutralize the negative impacts and consequences of the U.S. and Western anti-Moscow sanctions through closer cooperation and rapprochement. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You're listening to I'm Atah, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sayyid Murtaza, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Thank you very much for inviting.
Thank you very much again for accepting my invitation to the program Viewpoints. Today we want to talk about the personality of Jesus Christ, or Isa ibn Maryam, Hazrat Masih. Also, these are the titles that are used for Prophet of Allah, and also Lady Mary or Hazrat Maryam, as pictured in the religion of Islam and the Quran, and the respect that Islam had for these two very dear personalities. Samir Salih Islam with you, brother, how the religion of Islam looked at the very personality of Hazrat Masih.
Thank you very much. You know, Jesus, in English name,
yes,